I was just a young, unthinking teenager when I first started reading Spider-Man. But the years have a way of slipping by, of changing the world about us. And every boy, sooner or later, must put away his toys and become a man. But until then, welcome back to the all-new Amazing Spider Talk.
Too many who know the angles, uncover and untangle all the questions and the webs left out to tangle. Be in 1962, last Wednesday's afternoon, they'll bend your ears with reckless self-abandon. The Amazing Spider-Talk. The Amazing Spider-Talk. Come swing through the air, sit back and prepare for the Amazing Spider-Talk.
Hello, I'm Dapper Dan Gavazin, and I'm the founder and editor of SuperiorSpiderTalk.com.
And I'm mischievous Mark Giannacchio, founder of the Chasing Amazing blog and author of 100 Things Spider-Man Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die.
Mark, we're back!
I'm back, and you're back.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us for the first ever episode of the second season of the all-new Amazing Spider Talk. We hope you enjoy this podcast and that it provides an intelligent conversation between two fans and collectors as we look at the Spider-Man comics universe in a bit of a bigger picture. Yep, you see, Mark and I have been collecting Spider-Man comics our entire lives and eventually completed both of our chases of collecting every issue of Amazing Spider-Man. And for the past 5 years, we've been discussing everything Spider-Man related with each other, Spider-Man's various creators, and with you, our listeners. Our podcast, the all-new Amazing Spider-Talk, of course, it can be found on iTunes, YouTube, Google Play, and Stitcher for your listening enjoyment. And as with any other beginning, I want to welcome all the new listeners who've never tuned into a show before, that are tuning in for the first time to this episode. So I wanted to say welcome to the show. I hope you enjoy our conversation and that you consider sticking with us on our journey.
Yes, Dan, the Amazing Spider Talk has always been about you and I talking passionately about the past, present, and future of Spider-Man. And, of course, that's what we're going to do today. Because in this, the season premiere of a second season of our show, we're going to be talking about how Spider-Man finally hit the big time. No, we're not jumping all the way to the Dan Slott era of Spider-Man, just to clear up any confusion. No. Instead, we're going to be talking about the Stan Lee, John Romita Sr. run on Amazing Spider-Man, as well as all of the other amazing television shows, toys, Spider-Man merchandise, lunchboxes, whatever. I think they were like race cars with Spider-Man on them. I mean, whatever you could put his face on. That were inspired by Spider-Man's newfound popularity in the 1960s.
Yeah, and that means we're going to be covering everything from Amazing Spider-Man number 39 to issue number 100, that big, bold 100 issue in this season, which you can find just about anywhere from your local comic book store, which is, I guess, our preference, right, Mark?
Absolutely.
You can also find them online pretty much anywhere, from Marvel's Unlimited platform to Comixology if you want. So whether you've read these issues a million times or really never at all, we hope you enjoy our very first episode entitled I'm So Pretty.
Oh, so pretty.
So when you came on board Amazing Spider-Man, you took over for Steve Ditko. You took over for Ditko, who had really created a very idiosyncratic, very unique style of Spider-Man. First few issues, you managed a gradual transition in the art style.
It was hard.
but eventually you found your way. And your Spider-Man is very different from Ditko's. How would you describe the difference between what Steve did and what you did with Peter Parker and with Spider-Man and everyone else?
Well, some of it was technique, because I was a brush man. When I used to do the romances, I worked with a brush. And I could get some nice thick and thin accents and good clothing textures and things like that. Ditko was a pen man. And I felt obliged to do Spider-Man and 9 panels like Ditko, because that's what the fans are used to. And I tried for the first year to use a pen, which was hard for me. I lost my flair. But I tried it. And I think maybe in the beginning of the second year, I started to cheat and use a brush a little bit more. And you could see my stuff was somewhat Ditko-like for 6 or 7 months. But slowly but surely, I had to put some brush technique in there for weight. And it's slowly but surely, Stan said, you know what? Don't try anymore. Do it the way you want to do it.
All right, Dan. So before we get into the meat and potatoes of our show, which is going to include a really special guest, we should talk a little bit about kind of who is going to be at the focal point of a lot of the season. I mean, we talked a lot about Stan Lee in the first season of our show, kind of vis-a-vis him and Steve Ditko. But now we have John Romita Sr. entering the mix here. I mean, he is an artist extraordinaire. He took over for Ditko on Amazing Spider-Man on issue number 39. One of the things that I always thought was funny was Romita said in countless other interviews that he always thought it was going to be a short-term gig, because he was convinced that Lee and Ditko were going to reconcile their differences. He had no idea how irreparable things were and how Ditko had just pieced out. So because of that, if you look at the first few issues, mainly that two-parter that he did with the Green Goblin, where the Goblin unmasked Peter and then Peter unmasked the Goblin, and it's Norman Osborn. Romita says outright he was aping Ditko. He was like, I didn't want to change the style, the visual tone of the book all that much, because Ditko was going to come back and everyone would have been really ticked off about it.
But he didn't do the best job of that. It is undeniably Romita.
Yeah, I mean, the difference is very apparent. Right from Jump Street, but you could still tell there's an uncertainty in his pencils versus what he would end up doing just a handful of issues later, at least from my perspective. I mean, it's certainly different, but it got even more different, I guess, is what we're gonna say.
You're not kidding.
Romita wasn't a total stranger to Spider-Man, though. Interestingly enough, you know, Stan Lee clearly was getting the sense over the mid, you know, during the mid 60s that Ditko was not long for Marvel. So Romita, who is penciling Daredevil, and for issue number 16 in Daredevil, Lee pitched to Romita to do a Spider-Man story. And Romita learned after the fact that this was basically a tryout for him. So there you go. I mean, that's and wasn't that an answer to a question that you got, Dan, that got you an autograph from Romita?
That's exactly right. Yeah, that was one of the questions. What was his first time drawing Spider-Man in a Marvel comic book?
Yeah, obviously a fact that Dan will never forget, because, you know, he got that great signature on Spider-Man No More, I believe, Amazing Spider-Man number 50.
Yeah.
But it's also worth noting, even before Daredevil, I mean, Romita was not a newbie to the world of comics. You know, his claim to fame, though, wasn't superhero books. He did romance comics for DC during the 50s. And
you can even tell.
Yes, obviously. And we'll get into how you can tell. And even before he joined Marvel officially, apparently he had worked for Marvel or Timely Comics, depending on the name of the label at that point, for Stan Lee, but not in an official capacity. There were apparently a couple of artists that were not very good at making deadlines, and they went to Romita to ghost their pages. And when Romita finally left DC and decided he wanted to get back into comics again when Marvel was kind of juicing up its superhero line, he went into Marvel's offices and they were like, kind of like, oh, who are you? He's like, oh, you've worked with me before, and showed him all the pages that he had ghosted for these other people. and lo and behold, he got hired right away. You know, that kind of started the relationship there. And Romita, just he became a part of the framework right away. I mean, he was kind of everything, I guess, that Ditko and also Jack Kirby was not in terms of getting along with Stan Lee and being a company guy. And he was rewarded as such, because when Stan Lee eventually went on to become publisher of Marvel, Romita was named art director. So this was kind of after his run on Amazing Spider-Man. And while he was an art director, Romita had a hand in designs of characters like The Punisher, Wolverine, Luke Cage, Bullseye. So, I mean, like the influence is just absolutely profound that this guy's had in terms of his style, the character creations, just his overall management style. So,
not to mention his son.
And then, of course, his son, he spawns great artists, John Romita Jr., JRJR. So, again, like we're just, Romita's impact is just profound. And that's what we're going to be talking about a lot this season. I mean, we're going to be talking about more than just Romita. I mean, it's kind of that era of like 65, 66 to 70. But I think, Dan, rather than just having people hear us gush about how great John Romita is, we should bring in our first guest of the season to talk about him. He's a newbie to the show. No, this is his, actually his fourth time joining us on Amazing Spider Talk. This is Jerry Conway, who, in addition to being a great writer on Spider-Man from both the 70s, he was Stan Lee's first replacement on Amazing Spider-Man, but he also came back in the 90s. He worked closely with Romita during that era where Romita was art director. Romita illustrated issues of Spider-Man with him. So I don't think anyone quite knows Romita as well, who would come on a show, as Jerry Conway. So, Jerry, welcome aboard.
Hi, guys. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Anytime.
Well, Jerry, as you just heard, you know, we're really excited here in this season here. We're going to be talking about, you know, the John Romita Stan Lee run on Amazing Spider-Man and some of the adjacent properties that kind of sprung forth from that in the late 60s and early 70s. When we've talked to you in the past, Jerry, you've mentioned that, you know, prior to you joining the book in, you know, Amazing Spider-Man for the first time in the 1970s, I mean, you were a fan of the character. I think you've talked about like the Cry Master arc with the Ditko Lee one as being an early influence for you. Certainly some of the street level stories that you ended up doing on the book, but I'm going to make the assumption that you are following the book as it transitioned from Ditko to Romita. And, you know, we have obviously the power of hindsight here to kind of judge what really happened to the book in the long run. But I'm wondering if you can go into like the Wayback Machine and kind of put yourself in your teenage shoes about what you were thinking, especially, I mean, it seemed like the first few issues Romita was kind of being conservative and almost like he's even said he kind of was aping Ditko to a degree. But, you know, it wasn't too long before the style of the book started to shift dramatically. And I'm curious, you as a fan, what you thought, if you can recall that at all.
Well, I remember that my initial reaction was a shock, obviously, because we had by that point 3 or 4 years of Ditko on Spider-Man, and the style of Spider-Man was so tied to Ditko's storytelling and artistic approach that when Romita came on the book, it felt like it was almost a completely new book, and it was a strange shock. I, and the weird thing for me is that I had read the book as you said from almost very near the first issue. I think I started reading it with like issue 6 or 7. And I had just gotten a subscription to the book with about 2 issues or 3 issues before Romita came on. So when he came on, I felt kind of betrayed that my favorite book, you know, was suddenly now in the hands of somebody completely different who even though he was trying to ape Ditko, his style was so at variance with Ditko's style that it initially felt wrong, you know. Now, that's not to say I didn't come to love it, you know, because I did. And pretty quickly, I mean, it was the Mary Jane Watson reveal that got me to buy in completely to the Romita version of Spider-Man. But Spider-Man, for years, never quite felt, I think for the first 2 years under Romita, didn't feel like it was the same guy. That the figure work didn't feel like it was the same Spider-Man. And it took a while for Romita's approach to really settle in for me as a reader.
I'm curious, that transition, how was that announced to the readers at the time? Was there any idea that the book would be changing artists, or it just appeared and there was a new guy drawing it?
I'm not sure whether it was mentioned in a previous issue's letter column. It might have been foreshadowed. But this was also, I think, around the time that some new books were coming out, some new changes were being made in other titles, you know, like Submariner was being added to Tales to Astonish. Captain America was being added, I think, to Tales of Suspense. So there was a sense that things were changing at Marvel, you know, and I'm not like as conservative a reader as fans are today, you know, when they all hate any change. But for, when this happened, I think, let's see, it would have been around 65 when Ditko left. So I would have been about 13, which is prime comic book reading age. You know, yeah. It's like, and I was very invested in those characters at that time. And I think it was just kind of felt like it came out of nowhere. You know, I mean, Romita was not known at that point as a Marvel artist, even though I think he had filled in on a couple of books prior to that. But suddenly, you know, you had Romita on Spider-Man, you had Marie Severn on Doctor Strange. Dan Adkins, I think, did a Doctor Strange or two. So there was this real sense of the old guard is changing in ways that felt very uncomfortable to a reader who was invested in that material.
You were ready to jump right on Twitter and yell about it, weren't you?
I don't know. You know, I wasn't happy. I'll be honest. I'll be honest. I was not happy, but I did adapt to it. You know, I did come around. As I say, when Mary Jane showed up, I bought in, and I figured, well, you know, there are compensations. You know, there are compensations, because Ditko had never managed to draw a beautiful female lead, even though I liked Betty Brant. I never thought that she was particularly beautiful or attractive, but gee whiz, you know, Mary Jane and Gwen Stacy, they were certainly something for, you know, the adolescent boy to start responding to.
Yeah. I mean, even before we get into like some of like the newer characters, I mean, you can kind of see with Romita, just from even the old guard, so to speak, you know, the characters like Peter and Aunt May and Jonah, mm-hmm. like May wasn't so, I always found she didn't look so skeletal and frail. Like sure. He kind of gave her a little, you know, she was a little more full bodied. I mean, of course, Peter, I mean, the face is rounder. He's more muscular. He's smiling more. I mean, the smiling, I think that to me probably would have been the biggest shock in real time.
Yeah. Well, it was like a recasting, you know, it would be like today, you know, replacing Tobey Maguire with Andrew Garfield. There was a sense of, you've settled into one interpretation of the character, and then you have a very different, no less effective, but, you know, just a different take. But Stan's writing remained consistent. The plotting obviously changed, because Ditko is basically plotting the Spider-Man stories, and had a very intricate storytelling style and intricate plotting style that took John a while to begin to settle into himself. John was eventually became a master storyteller and taught me a lot of what I knew about how to write Spider-Man. Initially, he and Stan were trying to pick up the slack in ways that neither of them were particularly comfortable with, you know, because Ditko had been doing so much of it. I don't think Stan had plotted an issue of Spider-Man for like 2 years but at that point. So, you know, he had to basically come in and rediscover the characters and the relationships and the storylines that Ditko had started to weave. And I'm not sure that you know that either of them was really effective at that for at least about a year. So you know, the book sounded the same, but it didn't look the same, and the pacing was and the storytelling was all very different. So it suddenly went from one kind of a book to another kind of book in a way that we just as readers at that time weren't expecting.
Right out of the gate, you got that two-parter, which, you know, we had a couple of those in the Ditko run, but, you know, to really start the book off fresh and anew, the pacing is almost immediate. You know, we've got mm-hmm. this meaty story carried over two different issues.
Yeah, and tying up big plot threads that have been left dangling for a year and a half, you know, in a lot of cases. I mean, the whole resolution of the Green Goblin storyline, the arrival, I mean, Peter graduating college, you know, and meeting Harry. I mean, all this stuff, you know, that had been percolating, just coming to a head and then rushing forward. It was very different, as I say. But Marvel was exploding at that time in a lot of ways. I mean, that was also the period of Kirby just exploding with his storytelling in Fantastic Four. And then all the additional stories that were, you know, additional series that were developing the other books, too.
I got to ask you super quick with the Green Goblin thing. I mean, we have, and we've joked about it a lot, certainly in season one, you know, the different versions of history of who was the Green Goblin going to be, and this is what drove Ditko from the book. I mean, you knew some of the key players here, certainly John and Stan. What was kind of the version of history that you were told for that at the time? Well, I'm curious.
I mean, it was settled history by the time I came there. You know, I mean, there it was Norman Osborn was the Green Goblin. I think that was probably, I don't know if that was Ditko's intention, but it fit so easily into the storytelling that it seemed like it was the likely intention. On the other hand, it's also possible that Ditko was going to go and do something similar to what had been done, you know, in other books where, you know, you pull the mask off and it's somebody you've never seen. You know, yeah. Sort of like, who was that? We don't know. You know, he was obviously not as important as we thought. Ditko's plotting was strange. You know, I mean, he had his own peculiar approach to character and story. And sometimes I think he wanted to make larger points than Stan was interested in making.
You mentioned that Ditko's plotting is strange, and you can almost feel, I don't know if the relief of that when this book, like you said, kind of relaunches with this run. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Harry Osborn, but you know, you see a character like Harry Osborn who was very, you know, antagonistic and kind of negative alongside Gwen towards Peter under the Ditko era. But as soon as this book changes artists, you've got these characters who almost literally say in the text, like, let's be friendly now. And
right,
they all kind of
right.
change. Do you think that is the influence of Romita's pencils kind of being friendlier? Or is it something Stan Lee kind of, you feel like he always wanted to move that direction and finally had the real opportunity to plot something and really take over?
Well, I think you have the difference between Ditko and, I mean, one big difference between Ditko and Romita is that Ditko is fundamentally antisocial. And Romita is fundamentally social. I mean, both of them, you know, as individuals, just as people, Ditko you know, prefers to sit alone in isolation and create his work by himself, for himself, with no input from other people. John Romita sat in the middle of the bullpen drawing with people all around him and, you know, would engage in conversation while he was drawing. So, you know, it's just totally different personalities. Stan always, I think Stan had what I consider the TV star problem, which is there's a tendency of characters who play unlikable characters, actors who play unlikable characters on television. As those series progress, they start pushing to make their characters more likable because they are becoming more and more associated with those characters, and they want those characters to be likable because they want to be liked. You know, it's the Hot Lips Houlihan transition in MASH. Originally, she was portrayed as a complete negative character, and by the end of the series, she's one of the guys, because the actress really didn't want to continue doing the character as a complete negative character. And over time, you know, she had the ability to influence that. Stan wants to be liked. You know, that's his primary character. That's his, if anything motivates Stan in life, he wants to be liked. And so when he's writing characters, eventually he starts making those characters more and more likable. You know, I think it was his influence that started to make Victor Von Doom a more sympathetic character. It's his influence that made Dr. Octopus a more sympathetic character. And to the extent that he can, that his influence, you know, and John's basic sociability, you know, come together, you know, you have that that tendency, you know, getting to be more and more part of the approach of the book. So to the point where you basically don't have any characters who are unlikable at all. Yeah. By the time Stan left the book, there were no bad guys left among Peter's friends.
I mean, even a character like Jonah, I mean, Jonah is absolutely odious in the Ditko Lee run. And here, I mean, I think this is where the character becomes what J.K. Simmons ultimately did with the character in the Raimi movies. I mean, like, yeah, he's a jerk and a creep, but he's kind of a likable creep.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and he's our creep.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was sort of how Stan kind of mollified all those characters. He just, as I say, Stan wants to be liked, you know, so he had a hard time, I think, maintaining the, it's a matter of empathy. I mean, Stan is, you know, feels very empathetic towards his characters and doesn't want any of them to be perceived necessarily as a complete bad guy.
Well, not all of us can risk being criticized by killing a superhero's girlfriend.
That's right. You know, I mean, and that was very telling too. His response to that was to want to have have it all go away once he started getting criticism. So, me, I was willing to embrace the negativity, but you know, it's different personalities and how different people respond to what makes a character likable or unlikable. I've just found that under Stan and with John, you know, the book became a bit more, I don't know, a little less edgy, you know, than it was under Ditko.
Do you think John has similar sensibilities to Stan, or is just kind of how his style is?
I think it's mostly his style. He also is perfectly willing to do drama and to do negative characters. I mean, he is not unwilling to do that. But because he has this kind of easygoing style in his work, you know, this kind of generally friendly look to his art, that can give Stan the opportunity to write a more lighthearted book and a more lighthearted set of characters around Peter than he would have been able to do with Ditko.
Kind of bridging off that, I think Dan and we should talk to Jerry about the ladies of the Romita Lee run, right?
Sure.
Nothing like three ladies. Guys talking about ladies.
Comic book ladies. Well, you know, we are dealing with the murderer of one of these ladies, so we should talk. No, so obviously, I mean, we talked about like some of the existing characters and kind of the changes going through there. I mean, obviously, the introduction of Mary Jane Watson to the cast was a big shakeup for the book. I mean, here's this character showing up, looks like Anne Margaret. I mean, like, just crazy to have that into the book. And then, you know, I always like Romita tells this story about how after introducing MJ, Stan started to needle him about, oh, you got to make Gwen prettier now, too. So, like, you know, Gwen gets the hair band and is a little, you know, is less of the ice queen that she was during the Ditko run. I mean, I know that you, I think when we had you on the first time, when you were talking about, you know, the death of Gwen and kind of what led to that. I mean, you were kind of joking when MJ was first introduced in the book as a fan, you were thinking, well, this is the girl for Peter, right? I mean, it just seemed obvious. And then that never happened.
Yeah, it was, I think, a failed opportunity. But again, given Stan's own predilections, it's not unsurprising. I mean, Gwen actually was almost Stan's dream woman, you know, in a lot of ways. I mean, she even looked a little bit like Joan Lee. And, you know, tall, statuesque blonde. That's basically Stan. That was Stan's go-to. And I think he sort of lost a bit of lost the plot a bit, you know, in that regard, and became less about creating the necessary interest and conflict in Peter's life, and more about fulfilling Stan's own preferences and his own fantasies, you know. I mean, it is interesting that the way that Ditko obviously perceived Peter was as an outcast who would never be accepted by society and was always going to be put down by everybody around him and was always going to be beaten up by life. And Stan, while he certainly saw Peter as someone with problems, I don't think he fundamentally saw that Peter would be beaten up by life to the degree that Ditko did. So once Ditko was out of the way, Stan started to perform his own wish fulfillment through Peter. You know, where Peter's life started to come together in a lot of ways. While that's great for wish fulfillment, it does turn Peter into a bit of a Mary Sue, and you know, it's like. Where's the interest in that? You know, you want a character who's being challenged by life. And I think John would have John embraced that. You know, I mean, when we worked together, he was perfectly happy to put Peter through hell. that was fine with him. He saw it as a storytelling, but Stan just didn't push it in that direction. You know, the hardest he would get would be to have people that Peter cared about get in trouble. You know, Harry Osborn could have a drug problem. Aunt May could, you know, be in danger. Peter could be racked with guilt, you know, over not being able to save, you know, the father of his girlfriend. But Peter himself was, you know, not in emotional jeopardy that much during Stan's run with John.
He was certainly less neurotic, I would say.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that might contribute to why there are less hugely heralded issues during this run than, say, during the Ditko run? I mean, we've got, like, Spider-Man No More, but, you know, you go long stretches where, you know, people love these issues, but they're not holding it up as an all-time great.
Yeah. No, I think that's definitely true. I mean, this is where the weakness of Stan's plotting, you know, is most readily apparent. I mean, Stan is a phenomenal writer of dialogue and really understands how to create interesting characters. But when it comes to creating tension and plot, he really doesn't have a lot in his toolbox. And you add that, there's also really no compelling villain that comes out of that period. You know, the Prowler is okay, but, you know, the Kingpin is probably the most interesting villain that came out of that period. And the Kingpin really came into his own when it became a character in Daredevil. Up to that point, you know, he was more of a, you know, just a crime lord who looked like Sidney Greenstreet. You know, right. that I think had more to do with John's visual sense than anything else. But you had a string of really mediocre villains under Stan and John, not mostly because Stan, you know, without Ditko, couldn't really break out of some bad habits, you know, of like wanting to name characters that are, you know, fairly simple, you know, like characters like the Shocker, for example. I mean, right. You can't, there are all the characters who now show up in the, remember that series that they did?
Superior Foes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the second string villains who, you know, were making jokes out of. And I think that's unfortunate because John clearly could invent good, strong villains, but he needed Stan to provide him with the inspiration for them, you know, and with the exception of the Kingpin, there wasn't a lot in the inspiration department from Stan. But, you know, you had characters like the Kangaroo, you know, what? it's sort of like he understood that you could do animals, but he didn't know which animals would be really frightening to do. I think the rhino was a good character, but that was probably about it out of that batch.
He needed that deck of cards that DeFalco and friends apparently use and talk about all the time, right, Dan? The infamous animal cards.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
It is hard to create villains. I mean, it's a tough thing to do. So I'm not saying Stan, you know, is incapable of it, but certainly I think Ditko and Kirby had a better sense of it than Stan did.
Well, I mean, putting aside some of these villains and even some of how the look of some of these villains, like the Gibbon and the Shocker, who kind of looks like a plaid pillow or a sofa, right? There. But what was something that I thought that Romita was especially good at, and I'm just curious, like, what your take is, especially having worked with him, was costuming mm-hmm. for his characters. He I don't know. I mean, I think even more so than Kirby did. I mean, he really had a sense of modern fashion at the time. Am I just misinterpreting what modern fashion?
Yeah. No, he absolutely did. I mean, his books looked like the characters lived in the real world. I mean, it was a glamorous real world, but you know, he was taking from the fashion magazines of the era, the pop styles of popular culture. The books really, they reflected the heightened reality that comics should reflect, you know, of what's going on. I don't think Kirby had much of a sense of how people dressed, you know, in the 1960s. Yeah. But John definitely did. And he also had a good sense of what the real world could look like in a comic book, you know, in a similar way that Kirby did, Ditko did. Ditko's New York looked like a very gritty version of New York. But John's New York looked like the Madison Avenue version of New York that was also a real part of New York.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely felt like Ditko's was kind of more, it was an older New York. It's kind of like if you watch the mm-hmm. show Mad Men and how it was in the first season versus how it is towards, you know, like yes. That's Ditko. And then by the end of the 60s, there's Romita's version of New York and Spider-Man. Yeah. I mean, I think the only other artists around that time that really was kind of nailing that was Steranko, maybe, mm-hmm. in Fury. But it just kind of strikes me because it's something I don't even know if artists today consistently nail in terms of that sense of what do people actually look like in real life, you know, and it's just kind of an amazing attention to detail that I don't know Romita gets enough credit for sometimes.
Well, a lot of superhero artists aren't really interested in referencing the real world. They're more interested in referencing movies or other superhero artists. John came out of a commercial art background and a interest in newspaper strips, which were much more concerned with depicting the real world than comics. His heroes were people like I'm blanking on the artist who did Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
You know who I'm talking about. A senior moment. but that was his reference points. He loved those there were newspaper strips like Big Ben Bolt that he was a big fan of, and Rip Kirby, the newspaper strip. So those are his reference points, and that requires you to want to be an illustrator as much as wanting to be a cartoonist. And artists today don't really spend any time developing that part of the craft. You know, you sort of have to go to artists from Europe to really find that. You know, that's why people who do it well are some of the artists on Spider-Man right now, like Giancarlo. He did it really well.
Yeah.
But when you start going for the guys who are basically trying to draw a superhero, and their primary emphasis is on the superhero aspects of the story, they do tend to lack that attention to real world details that sell the book, you know, on a different level.
So you've worked with a lot of artists over the years. What was your working relationship like with Romita? Like, what was it like crafting a story alongside him?
Well, I was very much the student with the master. You know, when I came on that book, I was relatively new to Marvel. I think I'd been working there for about a year and a half on regular titles, and it was made clear to me that I was the junior partner. My name came second after John's, which was like I think the only time that an artist's name came first, and it was really to reflect the fact that John was the primary crafter of the stories that we did together. He and I would talk over a story. I would have an idea and a plot that I would want to do. You know, I like a character like Hammerhead. I wanted to do a gang war story, and so we would talk over that, and I'd come up with the Hammerhead idea, and then John would basically structure the story and, you know, show me how to tell this story in a way that I wouldn't have been able to do if I had been left my own devices. Because if you look at the work that I had been doing for the year and a half before I went on to Spider-Man, it was kind of chaotic, you know, in terms of my handling of subplots and sometimes leaving subplots dangling that never got picked up, you know, not necessarily effectively setting things up that were going to pay off later. John really taught me a lot about how to do that and how to pace a story internally so that you didn't end up with, you know, everything happening on the last two pages, which was a problem I'd sometimes have, you know, working with other artists. So he was a master storyteller and definitely brought me along.
Do you feel that, you know, it's interesting, a lot of your stories, certainly like the street level elements seemed to borrow from, you know, elements from the Dick Golee run. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, you're learning from John here in terms of storytelling. I mean, in terms of like your creative ideas, do you feel like one run influenced you more than the other? I mean, it was the immediacy of John kind of, did that tilt you in one direction or the other? Like how did that go for you?
My goal was to do the kind of stories that I loved when I was first reading Spider-Man. So I definitely was more influenced by Ditko. To be honest, I was not a big fan of the Lee Romita era before I started working at Marvel in 70, 69, 70. So I had sort of dropped off the radar on those books for a number of years. And I picked up on them again, you know, when I came back to Marvel I mean, when I came to Marvel as a writer in late 69, I started reading the material again and became a fan of it. But I wasn't, like, passionate about, oh, I've got to do a run that's similar to the Empire University run. You know, it's like that wasn't that was like in my head. I wanted to do a new Crime Master run. I wanted to do a new Master Planner run. I wanted to do stories, you know, about Aunt May, you know, on her deathbed. You know, I wanted to bring back Dr. Octopus and really make him a threat. You know, where he was not somebody who was kind of cuddly and unmenacing. I wanted him to be a monster. So that was where I was coming from. And as I say, John was perfectly okay with doing that. That was, you know, part of his. It's just a matter of he wanted to have the material. He responded to whatever material he was being asked to deliver, you know. If you wanted to go into a slightly darker storytelling mode, he was fine with that. He was a great collaborator.
When you had your second go around with the character in the '80s with Spectacular and Web of, I mean, did your kind of influences change a little bit for that, or were you still kind of going for the same thing?
Well, I think by that point the character had moved along in his development to such a degree that I couldn't really go right back to the same types of stories I had been doing before. But my desire when I came into doing the book in the late 80s was to find a way to tell stories about the supporting cast characters, because the main title, the Amazing Spider-Man title, was going to be focused on, you know, Peter and Mary Jane. So, in effect, I was forced to come up with a different approach, you know, entirely different approach than I would have done if I'd been writing the main book. So I can't really say that those stories represent my preferred approach to writing Spider-Man. They were sort of like, you know, like a side trip, you know.
Yeah. You were kind of put in that direction.
Yeah. I mean, my job on those books was to deliver stories that were entertaining that wouldn't necessarily change Peter's life. You know? No. So I could change Joe Robertson's life, which I did.
And you did.
Yeah. And that was fun for me, you know, and I think for the readers. So it was also fun to have an opportunity to create new villains and new characters that you know, could be separate from the main title, because the main title would have the big characters, you know, the big villains.
You know, something that I've always found interesting, just kind of like charting Spider-Man through the years. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, Ditko and Lee, they established so much that, you know, the Ditko is kind of considered the innovator, but obviously Romita changed the tone. Mm-hmm. And yet, so when you're looking at what people are doing today, or, you know, in the last 15, 20 years or so, it seems like when someone is trying to go epic, they're kind of culling from Ditko. But when there are these stories that are more looking for nostalgia and sentimentality, like a Spider-Man Blue, or even elements of Ultimate Spider-Man in the early going, I feel like it's very heavily influenced by the Romita Lee work. I mean, yes. It's, even though it's not as, like you said, those individual stories aren't as memorable, but it's just the aesthetic and the aura of it, right? It's just it just kind of screams nostalgia.
Absolutely, and also the other aspect is that when Romita took the book over, that's when the sales really took off. Spider-Man was a successful book with Ditko, but it became the most successful book with Romita. So a lot of people, a lot more people read Romita's Spider-Man than read Ditko's Spider-Man, which sometimes people miss, you know, because you think, oh, Spider-Man has always been Marvel's number one character. He really wasn't until Romita. He was definitely a popular character, but he wasn't the best-selling book. And there's like this trend line where the Fantastic Four was the most popular book for many, many years. And right around the time that Romita came onto Spider-Man, that trend line started to change. you know, where the Fantastic Four sort of started going into a slump around the time that Kirby became disaffected, you know, where you started seeing the same basic three stories every year. And at that same period, that's when the Romita Spider-Man started to increase in sales and became the book that started to drive Marvel into the mainstream. So the nostalgia for the Romita era is genuine because that's the book that most people ended up reading. You know, that's the version of Peter Parker that most people have in their head. And probably the most iconic, I mean, even though I think the most iconic sequence in Spider-Man is from the Master Planner story where Spider-Man is under the piles of rubble, you know, and he pushes his way up, you know, and throws it off because of his determination to save his aunt. That's probably the most iconic physical triumphant moment of Spider-Man, but the most iconic image of Spider-Man is the Spider-Man No More cover, you know, where Peter's walking away from the Spider-Man costume in the trash can. There's really no more iconic image that sells that internal despair, you know, that I can't ever make it, you know, kind of image of Peter Parker than that cover. So
where do you think that idea came from? Because it does seem, you know, as an issue, it really stands out from that run for being the one place that really dared to do something dramatic with Peter, even if it only was for like 5 to 10 pages. Where do you think that thought came from?
I think it came from John, because John was the one who came up with the idea to kill off a main character in my run. You know, I mean, he was the one who said, you know, we have to change things up. We have to give the reader something to shock them, you know, and to make them feel like things matter in the book. So that was his impulse. And I think whatever big iconic moments came during the Lee Romita era of Spider-Man were probably inspired by John saying something similar to Stan. And he probably had that visual in his head. You know, he probably thought to himself, gee, that would be a great visual. You know, I could make a great cover out of that. John was really good at cover design. So, you know, he may have had that idea as a cover image in his head and pitched it to Stan, and then they built a story around it. That would be kind of my idea, my guess. Because Stan also, just like with Ditko, eventually came to lean on John for storytelling. So, you know, that would be a really good example of a kind of story beat that John would propose.
But I think that story really seems to work in that context, again, because of kind of the what John and Stan had kind of built up in the issues preceding in terms mm-hmm. of the tone and the aesthetic, because it's, you know, we're dealing with, like, Peter had quote unquote quit Spider-Man before, during like, even the Ditko run. Sure. And yet, you know, here, like a few issues earlier, he's meeting, you know, he meets Mary Jane, he's being more social, Harry and Flash are being nice to him now. And it's like, you know, like the whole premise of that issue is this idea of, well, you know, I'm tired of getting kicked around as both Spider-Man and Peter. I'm just going to be Peter. And you're kind of almost, you almost kind of root for it as a reader. I feel like, I don't know if you rooted for it. I don't know if you were still recovering from the shock of it all at that point.
Well, I thought it was a great issue. I mean, I remembered it pretty vividly, you know, and I wanted to do something similar myself at some point. But yeah, I mean, you did feel like this is a guy who's been put upon, and he has to make a choice. And as you say, since he was getting along with people as Peter Parker, giving up Spider-Man might have made, you know, would have made emotional sense for him. You know, it's like, I can have one life where I can have, where people can kind of like me, or I can give up this other life where I'm doing all this work and getting no rewards for it. So yeah, makes sense.
Well, thank you so much, Sherry, for coming on and sharing again, you know, your experiences with John, and also, you know, as a collaborator, as a reader, as a fan, as a esteemed industry veteran and critic. I mean, but it's just a great perspective. All these perspectives just to kind of get in there and kind of kick off this season where we talk about all these issues. So again, we really appreciate it.
Well, great. It's a really interesting era. So I think you guys will have a lot of fun going forward.
So thanks for joining us for our first episode of our second season of the all new Amazing Spider Talk. Dan, our next episode will be out in 2 weeks on February 21st. What's the title of that show?
Yeah, it's going to be called The Parker Luck. And we'll be exploring the Peter Parker, Gwen Stacy, Mary Jane love triangle that I don't know if you agree with this, Mark, but it kind of never really was.
Yeah, and Jerry even alluded to that in his interview with us. So, yeah, I think it's kind of accepted. But people say it's a love triangle, so we're going to say it's a love triangle for the purpose of our show.
Yeah, and we could all be as unlucky as Peter Parker in that scenario. But if you ever wanted to throw down over whether MJ or Gwen was right for Peter, this will be the episode for you. You know, heck, you guys should send us a mail at amazingspidertalk@gmail.com and let us know. Are you a Gwen or a Mary Jane kind of person?
Yeah, is there some kind of like clever mishmash of names that we can? Are you Meter or Gweeter?
I hate that. I don't like that at all.
Okay.
Well, also, why don't you tell everybody about what we're doing on Patreon this week?
Yeah, we got a couple of things coming down the pipeline there. You know, Patreon subscribers, of course, if you subscribe to us, you will get additional exclusive content in your podcast feed. First up is going to be a special review of Amazing Spider-Man number 794. But also, we kind of got a little post-interview chit-chat with Jerry Conway about Renew Your Vows and his run on that book that kind of ended unexpectedly a few months ago. So if you want to hear about Jerry Conway and Renew Your Vows and what exactly happened there, I recommend you join up on Patreon, which you can do for just $3.99 a month, the price of a new comic, and get access to all this exclusive content like new issue reviews, Swarm B books, mailbags, and these little interviews. And for an extra bonus, for $10 or more a month, you'll get access to commissioned artwork. So you'll be supporting the continuation of the show and great artists. I mean, what's better than that, Dan?
Yeah, nothing. We love all of our Patreon supporters, and we'd love to have everybody join the club. So if you want to join, just go over to either of our websites. You can click on the button that reads Friendly Neighborhood Spider Talk Members Club, or you can go to patreon.com/superiorspidertalk and sign up and join us on the web. Speaking of the web, Mark, where can we find you on the old web?
Yeah, well, of course, you can find me on superiorspidertalk.com doing new review-ish articles, among other things. And you can find me at Chasing ASM Blog on the Twitter. And, of course, my book, Dan, it's an evergreen, I'm told. You can still buy it. 100 Things Spider-Man Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die from Triumph Books. Find it wherever books are sold. Dan, where can we find your stuff?
Well, I'll be reading your book again and posting about it on Twitter at @SupSpiderTalk. And I'm also, on my website, SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. You know, Mark, you and I tag-team these reviews. So you'll see some of my stuff there every now and again. And you can follow my personal Twitter account if you're so inclined to do so to see all the other stuff I'm doing. It's at Dan Gavazdin. You know, but Mark, we talked a lot. Jerry talked a lot, and it may not have been Uncle Ben who originally taught us Spider-Man's immortal lesson, but Stan Lee himself. What were those immortal words that he said that would reverberate throughout history?
I believe, Dan, he said, with great podcasts must also come the all-new Amazing Spider Talk.
Anytime.